The Great Canadian Talk Show.
There's only a couple of watts, but I brought the truth to everyone within three blocks of the west side of campus.
No way! Yes way!
And now, let's get right down to business with Marty Gold.
Welcome to the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast. This is episode 27 of season 4, our 27th episode of 2024. I'm Marty Gold. Once again, this episode is going to be dedicated to a specific topic, and it's going to be dedicated to one that is examining an international issue, the macrocosm, and then the microcosm, the bigger picture, and then the picture here in Manitoba, and it's going to be dedicated not specifically to anti-Semitism, as was a recent previous podcast, but that issue plays into this subject matter. Premier Wab Kanu issued a statement on March 11th. There are political reasons for the statement. I've not seen anybody in the local media directly address it. There was one guest opinion column in the Winnipeg Sun by Kevin Klein, no stranger to this podcast, that I will be raising later in the program when I get to the microcosm part. But let's look at the macrocosm. Gaza, the war in Gaza, and how it has swallowed almost every public endeavor, every facet of public life, now becomes enveloped in the politicization at national and local levels of a war thousands of miles away. Case in point, the Oscars. Nobody was talking really about Best Picture, Best Actor, this or that. They were talking about a speech that was made by a producer of a short film that won the Oscar. And this producer, joined on stage by his partner, James Wilson, and an executive producer, Len Blavatnik. Jonathan Grazer was the director of the film, rather, not the producer. Joined by the producer, and the director said a number of comments trying to distance himself and his film, which has great value in Holocaust education, from the conventional approach that is taken by pro-Israel Jews and everybody who is pro-Israel in the context of defeating Hamas. He said that he didn't want his Jewishness and the Holocaust to be hijacked. Somehow or other, it was hard for me to quite figure out what he was talking about. Didn't want that used as cover as an excuse for how the war was being conducted in Gaza, the loss of life, the destruction, etc. Variety, which, to digress, when I lived in Los Angeles at the turn of the century and was involved in the film business, that's the Bible. You wake up every morning, you read Variety and you read the Hollywood Reporter. Variety covering this. The executive producer, Danny Cohn, that means he put his money into this film, fundamentally disagreed. Cohn and Blavatnik financed the movie, which was about the commandant at Auschwitz, Rudolf Huss, and his family, and they lived next door to the death camp. And so there's all these pictures of the kids playing in the garden in the backyard, and behind it is basically crematoriums. And so Cohn and Blavatnik, also Jewish, put their money up. Took 10 years to make this film. And Cohen, a former director of the BBC, said he knows people or said a lot of people feel upset and angry about it. And I understand that anger, frankly. This was on a podcast this past week. And that a lot of people in the Jewish community who thought the film was crucial to Holocaust education, in other words, that somebody can be in charge of just mass slaughter and torture of innocent people, can live their life right next door to it, right next door to the smells and the sounds and everything else, and be all happy about it. That's the way it was when you were a Nazi. So they thought it was a good way to show how people become desensitized when others are dehumanized. And now that film has been mixed up with what's going on in Gaza. Turns out that when Danny Cohn made that speech, that Blavatnik, who was on stage with him, had no idea he was going to be saying those things. He had, I guess, apparently run this past James Wilson. Danny Cohn said he did not support the comments. "I just fundamentally disagree with Jonathan on this." And he strikes a position, Mr. Cohn does, that is, I believe, a position that the majority of Jewish communities and certainly the majority of Israelis agree with. "The war and the continuation of the war," he said, "is the responsibility of Hamas, a genocidal terrorist organization which continues to hold and abuse the hostages, which doesn't use its tunnels to protect the innocent civilians of Gaza, but use it to hide themselves and allows Palestinians to die. I think the war is tragic and awful, and the loss of civilian life is awful, but I blame Hamas for that." Now, these remarks by the director, by Jonathan Glazer, they got support among the loony left, the self-hating Jews, the supporters of these bizarre foreign affairs theories, foreign policy theories about, pan-Arab nationalism and such things, and those who see no danger in Islamists, and let there be no mistake, Hamas espouses Islamist values, if you can call slaughter all the Jews a value and slaughter all the infidels a value. And so Variety, getting a quote from the executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, which is essentially the equivalent of Independent Jewish Voices in Canada. And she, this was Stephanie Fox, whoever she is, "Glazer speaks for the massive and growing number of Jews who honor our histories by joining our Palestinian siblings in their struggle for freedom and justice. These are the kind of Jews who will be waiting to hold the clipboards and checking off their landsmen as they board the trains to go to the camps." As the language of nuts that overpopulate the progressive left, who are so blinded by their political ideology that they simply can't accept that Hamas isn't a rogue guerrilla outfit, but rather did what they did with not just the tacit support, but the active support of the majority of residents of Gaza. And as we've learned this week, women from the ages of teenagers into their 70s assisted in the taking and holding and torturing of captives. So that's the macrocosm. Hollywood has become absorbed this past week with this, as has the Canadian government, desperately trying to avoid situations. And no matter what they do, as I record this Friday night, big fundraiser in Toronto, and Prime Minister Trudeau having to evacuate out a back door when it was said and done because of the masses gathered in front, because no matter what the Trudeau government does, it's never enough for the pro-Hamas crowd in Canada. Suspend the sale of certain kinds of arms and equipment, not good enough. Reinstate funding to UNRWA, which is a totally anti-Semitic organization, in a complete abdication of any responsible use of tax dollars, seeking to placate the mobs, still not good enough. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Melanie Joly, went to the Middle East for 3 days this week and managed, as explained by Rahim Mohammed in the National Post, puts up $1 million towards investigating sexual and gender-based violence, the rape of Israeli women, not mentioning the men that were sexually assaulted before their murder by these terrorists. Puts up $1 million one day to virtue signal to the Jews, puts up $1 million the next day to investigate allegations of sexual and gender-based violence against Palestinian women. Tweeting, "We believe Palestinian women," Joly said. So one day we believe Israeli women, and the dead bodies, mutilated bodies, clearly violated bodies. That's the evidence on one side. The other side seems to be a little lacking. Israel's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism is the daughter of the former anti-Semitism envoy in Canada, former Liberal cabinet minister and member of parliament, longstanding member of parliament in Montreal, Erwin Kotler. Michal, his daughter, Michal Kotler-Wunsch, went after Joly for, as she put it, perpetuating a false moral equivalence. Hamas coordinated the use of sexual torture on October 7th. And on the other hand, you have allegations of sexual misconduct, perhaps levied against individual Israelis. Canadian tax dollars supporting blood libel inversion of fact and law, Kotler-Wunsch wrote on Twitter. Trudeau and Joly finding no... and might I add, Joly posing with Yara Sachs, another cabinet minister, and a Jewish one at that, posing with the leader of the Palestinian Authority, a Holocaust denier, who set up a fund to pay the families of the so-called martyrs who engaged in this raid into Israel, and the pillage and the torture and the destruction and the murder. Here's a guy committing funding, like well-paid welfare, to the families of those perpetrators. And here you got two members of Trudeau's cabinet shaking hands with him and smiling and all cozying up to him. Yara Sachs is going to be feeling the brunt of that betrayal of women, of her constituents, and of the Jewish community for a long time. Joly also getting it on social media and in other places. As Rahim Mohammed describes her in his National Post commentary, describes Melanie Joly as a self-styled feminist foreign policy evangelist. She isn't doing her own cause any favors, he wrote, by applying different standards to claims of sexual violence committed against Israeli and Palestinian women. One must also question Joly's enthusiasm for an investigation into sexual violence in Gaza, he wrote, that could divert global attention away from obtaining justice for the scores of Israeli women and girls who we know for a fact were victimized on October 7th. And here's the big point of what he wrote. Why, in other words, is Joly insistent on all lives mattering the organized sexual violence perpetrated by Hamas on October 7th? There's no indication anything approximating the scale and savagery that Hamas tore through southern Israel has since occurred in Gaza to suggest otherwise is an affront to reality. Calling Melanie Joly a faux feminist by cynically perpetuating a harmful false equivalency. Now, why would a cabinet minister from the Trudeau government do that? That is, of course, to save their ass, because they fear the mob. As Mohammed put it, her insistence on helping Israel's enemies muddy the waters and obscure the horrors on October 7th, and could only do a disservice to all women and girls who bear the brunt of the use of rape as a weapon of war, shall now have to live with this decision and the shadow inevitably casts over her legacy as foreign minister. Along the lines of the bigger picture, Joe Roberts, the guy that I've become more familiar with through Twitter, He was the head knock at JSpace Canada, which is a organization that promotes a two-state solution, Jewish organization, promotes a two-state solution, and is, by definition, progressive. He quit on February the 5th, and he's a pro-Israel, pro-peace progressive Zionist. That's how he describes himself. And when he took over JSpace, he said he was concerned about the new extremist Israeli government. This week he tweeted, Justin Trudeau's legacy will be the abandonment of our allies, leaving Canada cannot answer the call of NATO, but happily answers the call of the anti-Semitic mob, calling it shameful. That's the macrocosm, the bigger picture. Now the microcosm. When I come back from this break, we're going to look at Wahb Kanu's statement. We're going to look at the analysis not only of Kevin Klein from the, in the pages of the Winnipeg Sun. I've got a few of my own observations about Kanu conveniently left out or ignored. I'm going to look at what his motives were, how he got pushed into this, why it came out on Monday, this gambit. I'm also going to read to you a response from a former Manitoban, a former classmate of mine that I graduated high school with, who saw the Kanu statement and wrote a response from the perspective of a Winnipegger who lives in Israel, who has to take shelter from bombs and rockets, whose children are serving in the IDF, and who says that Wahb Kanu has not a hot clue, but well understood what he was trying to achieve with his both sides-ism statement about caring about the Jewish community and caring about the Muslim community in Winnipeg and in Manitoba. Back with more right after this.
The Great Canadian Talk Show podcast is always listening to you. Send in your comments, story tips, and ideas to martygoldlive@gmail.com, TGCTS, making sure your voice is heard.
For your home renovation and repair needs, call PKP. For over 20 years, we've built trusted relationships in the North End, West Kildonan, Garden City, and the Maples. Buying a refurbished home? We'll do your pre-purchase inspection and make sure you get what you're paying for. Go to our Facebook page, PKP Renovations and Repairs, or call us 204-297-5446. That's 204-297-5446. PKP Renovations and Repairs.
And they're saying the judge got it wrong. Everyone got it wrong. Everyone is wrong. But the city of Winnipeg.
Jamrock Security has effective and creative ways to help protect your business, your home, and your community. Jamrock gets the job done so you can rest easy. Go to jamrocksecurity.ca or call us at 204-880-1564. Do security. Do it smart. Jamrock Security.
Back with more of episode 27. All episodes of the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast are available on actionline.ca under the podcast tab. As well, when you look at our main page, there's the last tab is blogs. And I'm going to be adding an article that helps explain the modern day phenomena of the minimizing the reality of what Jews face in terms of anti-Semitism, what Jews face in the Middle East. A piece that was written by Dr. Raphael Medoff. And I was amazed by this. Medoff is, among other things, he's an expert on the subject of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And what his administration did and did not do leading up to and during the Second World War. And the attitude towards Jews and the victims of the Nazis. And it's amazing the degree to which the mere mention of the word Jews was avoided literally for years by Roosevelt. Because ultimately, that was a very anti-Semitic administration. As Arthur Sizek, who was a Jewish artist and activist at the time, he said that the persecution of Europe's Jews was being treated as a pornographic subject. You cannot discuss it in polite society. And we see that in the present day in terms of what goes on college campuses in the U.S., where events that were planned or proposed to recognize the horrors inflicted on residents of southern Israel, the Gaza envelope, that in at least one case they were told, no, it can't be presented that way. You can't be mentioning Israel. You can't be focusing only on the Jews. What mass rape by a military organization was there in Gaza on October 7th or any time around then? Of course, none. That was in Vermont. And so I'm going to publish Dr. Medoff's piece on our blog. There's going to be a link in the episode description. I want you to take a look at that to see how embedded in governments this avoidance, even in a 1944 statement commemorating the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt, somehow Roosevelt did not use the word Jews. In 82 press conferences Roosevelt held in 33, the subject of the oppression of Jews in Europe arose once. And it took another 348 presidential press conferences before FDR said anything publicly again about the Jews. What's old is new again. We see the same pattern. So I'm going to post that. Now, Wahb Kanu mentioned Jews, he mentioned Israelis, he mentioned anti-Semitism. And I call this a gambit. Why? Now you look at the dictionary definition of a gambit. It's and I didn't realize this, it's from the Italian gambetto, the act of tripping someone with the leg to make them fall, right? So somebody's running past, stick your leg out, they take a tumble. So gambit is derived from that. It traditionally meant it's a chess move where you'll sacrifice a piece, or you set yourself up to sacrifice something to draw out the other side to then get a subsequent positional advantage. It also means it's a remark intended to start a conversation or make a telling point. Another dictionary definition, a calculated move or stratagem. And that is what Wahb Kanu was up to on Monday, when he said, today I call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Now he tried very carefully to straddle the fence on this, opening up with saying Hamas should be destroyed. I abhor the carnage of October 7th. I've heard the outcry in the Palestinian community and beyond. Laments the division the war has caused for people in Manitoba, for the Muslim Manitobans have been targeted by Islamophobia. Or were the Jewish Canadians afraid to go to class because of anti-Semitism? Is it Islamophobic to be concerned or afraid of people who express support for Hamas, who chant things like Intifada? Well, Kanu doesn't want to address that. He wanted to talk about the emergence of famine in Gaza and respect for human rights, pluralism, a commitment to advance reconciliation. He did say, I respect it on their face. The comments I make today may cause hurt in some quarters. And he said he has a great desire to be a good friend and ally to Manitoba's Jewish community and someone who firmly believes in Israel's right to exist. I ask with the greatest of humility my fellow Manitobans ponder the rationale I lay out with an open mind. So he's trying to be everybody's friend with this. And by everybody, it appears that means everybody. Now, why did he do this? Before we get more into the meat and potatoes of this, of what he wrote. Pressure was put upon various Manitoba politicians and leaders by those at the forefront of the local Palestinian community, who, you note, have never once denounced Hamas, have never once called for a surrender, have never called for the release of the hostages. If I'm wrong, please send it to me. I'll correct the record, but I don't think I'm wrong. And they put a lot of heat on a lot of politicians, and I know because I heard from some of them. They wanted politicians to come out in favor of a ceasefire because this is a tool that's wielded in the court of public opinion. And the alternative is blockades, protests, social media campaigns, and all sorts of other uncomfortable consequences for elected officials. So when people ask me, well, why was this written and what's the end game? It was written because there was a lot of pressure on Canoe, and the end game is to avoid protest marches by these mobs. One comment, the letter sounds like it was written by someone who wasn't necessarily all there. I don't think he actually wrote it himself. Now, the first question, as Canoe puts it, the first question, is this the only way to conduct a war against Hamas? That's a reasonable question, but keep in mind, Wahb Canoe, to the best of my knowledge, was not a cadet, has no military training, has no military experience. I don't even know if he's ever held in his hand a legal gun. But he starts to ponder, is this the only way to conduct a war against Hamas? And on the one hand, saying Israel's justified in targeting Hamas, given their intention to kill Jewish people based solely on their identity, he says, I know the war cabinet of Israel had a choice in how it decided to conduct the war. Now, keep in mind, when he could criticize the war cabinet, you see, he goes beyond this Netanyahu business, because that's a unity cabinet there. So he's not only criticizing the so-called extremist right, he's criticizing the entirety of the Israeli government and the choice they made. The decision, wrote Canoe, was whether to target Hamas narrowly with the maximum amount of protection for civilian life in Gaza, or to prosecute the war in a manner which showed little regard for civilians, their homes and infrastructure, or the food and water necessary to sustain life. And right there you can see that somebody else wrote this, and that Wahb Canoe didn't spend a minute going, is this true? Showing little regard for civilians. He's accusing the government of Israel, or more so the IDF, I guess, of showing little regard for civilians, which explains the millions of leaflets and 20 million or more phone calls that were made to civilians to tell them to get out of harm's way. After 5 months of war in Gaza, he says, have we seen the government of Israel wage this war in a way that is narrow and targeted, in a way that shows little regard for civilians? You'll hear the response from an Israeli shortly in regards to this. Civilian lives must be protected, he wrote. The second question is whether to just hold people collectively responsible for the few. Consider the Jewish students who face hostility in Manitoba campuses, he wrote, because of the actions of the government of Israel. There's a reminder for us to continue to support the Jewish community in Manitoba through this difficult period, and remind any advocates for Gaza to not veer into anti-Semitism. Well, they were doing that right on October 7th when they marched on City Hall. And Canoe, Mayor Gilliam, both spoke out against it. They've done nothing since. They know there's a contingent of Jew haters, Hamas lovers, to take part in these protests and marches. Well, we're reminding, he says, he's reminding advocates for Gaza, don't fear anti-Semitism or else what? Nothing. Or else nothing. He then asks if it is anti-Semitic to hold Jewish people collectively responsible for the actions of the government of Israel, then what is it if the Palestinian people appear to be held collectively responsible for the inhumane actions of Hamas. Apparently, Wahb Kanu has never studied war, and he's certainly never studied the Second World War. And if he's worried about collective punishment, should people be collectively responsible for the actions of a few? Looks to me that in Manitoba and in Canada, that passes down generationally. Whenever there's some allegation, accusation, or instance where there was a minority group that was discriminated against, especially by the government in Ottawa that was seated by the people of Eastern Canada, because the West had literally no say in who was going to get elected. But we all pay the price when there's legislation passed to try to remediate things, payments, allowances, things that are done to try to alleviate generations of suffering caused by the actions that go back to whether it's William Lyon Mackenzie King or any prime minister after that, all the way through to Trudeau Senior. Every single discrimination charge about the history of Canada or Manitoba, well, we to this day are held collectively responsible. Apparently, Wahb Kanu didn't see the videos of the bodies, live and dead, dragged back to Gaza, and the celebration, the desecration of those bodies by Gazans. Kanu, apparently an expert on international affairs now, saying that international norms and conventions would ask world powers to distinguish between civilians and aggressors. How do you distinguish between aggressors? When the population full-throatedly endorsed the attack on Israel, the breaking of that ceasefire, and in some cases held hostages inside their own hospitals, inside their own homes, especially if they were a teacher with a United Nations agency. He then gets into the issue of famines. Why is it said that a quarter of the population of Gaza is now visited by famine? Well, apparently, again, Wahb Kanu not following the news about the hijacking of aid, and we'll get into that. The famine in Gaza is caused by the war. Well, Kanu was wrong. The famine in Gaza is caused by Hamas. Specifically, he said it is caused by the way the war is being waged. Again, total bullshit. And on and on and on he went. And the fourth question, what does it mean for us to be a good ally? A good ally to Israelis and Jewish people, and a good ally to Palestinians and Muslims. And he tries to focus on human rights. And again, he goes in circles. He goes back, Israel's an important ally in the Middle East. Israel's our ally. But doesn't a true relation mean telling your friend about your concerns or remind them of the values that resonate with Jewish people, Muslims, and all Manitobans? Do you think Wahb Kanu has once called up any of the leaders of the local Palestinian community and said, hey, what's with these chants for Intifada? What's with these chants of from the river to the sea? Why haven't you called for the hostages to be released? And of course not! Each day the war continues, he says, pushes the prospect of reconciliation in our province further and further away. Finally, at the end, the hostages should be freed immediately. The sexual violence is a violation of our collective humanity. Hamas should be eliminated. I say these things and still I call for a ceasefire. It is time for a ceasefire. Kevin Klein responding to the Winnipeg Sun. I'll provide a link to it. The headline, Kanu's call for Israel-Hamas ceasefire, just political pandering. It all sounds warm and fuzzy, speaking, Klein was, of the Kanu statement, but it's an obvious attempt to politically pander to constituents, especially given neither Hamas nor the Israeli government would take direction from Mr. Kanu. It's a nice soundbite. The problem is it reveals a tremendous amount of ignorance and naivete on the part of our premier's call for a ceasefire. Demonstrates he does not understand what's happening in the region. Klein got that right. And as for the aid, Hamas, as Klein put it, do not appear interested in humanely distributing food and medicine to the population they govern and claim to represent. Shooting its citizens through use of aid trucks is not an act of good governance. And that has led to the airdrops. International Aid, he said, and assistance are meaningless if the governing entity of the region does not wish for it to be received by its people, by the people. Calling for a ceasefire, Klein concluded, may serve a political agenda, but it will not serve either Palestinians or Israelis well if it allows Hamas to regroup, maintain its brutal stranglehold on the region. Talk of a dual state solution with Hamas is naive and reckless. A ceasefire now will only facilitate greater atrocities in the cycle of war with Hamas. Mr. Kanu knows this. But is more interested in being everybody's friend and ally to suit his political agenda. Klein getting that bang on correct. Now, as for this notion of ceasefire, before I go on to the break, here is from Tuesday, audio of the National Security Advisor at the White House, Jake Sullivan. And maybe this is, again, an example of the kind of facts that Wahb Kanu either wasn't aware of or didn't want to admit to. Here's Jake Sullivan criticizing not only Hamas, but the way the media covers Hamas.
When it comes to the issue of the hostage talks, one of the things that I have found somewhat absent from the coverage is that what we are talking about in the first phase is women, elderly, and wounded civilians. Those who would like to see a ceasefire in Gaza, a ceasefire is on the table today for 6 weeks to be built on into something more enduring if Hamas would simply release women, wounded, and elderly. And the fact that they will not do so says a lot to me about Hamas's regard for innocent Palestinian civilians. The fact that they are holding on to those folks and refusing to release them and refusing to step up and say that we could get this ceasefire in place, which not only would bring calm to the fighting, but also would create an enormous opportunity to flow humanitarian assistance in much greater quantities, because a significant part of the problem on the humanitarian assistance front, as you know, has not just been getting trucks into Gaza, but getting trucks around Gaza, because it is difficult to move them in light of all of the fighting. Now, we've also encouraged Israel to stay at the table, stay engaged, because we believe that there still is scope for this deal to get done.
So Wahb Kanu blames the Israeli government for the scope of the destruction, but doesn't blame Hamas for refusing to accept the ceasefire. Who's he catering to? One other thing that neither Kanu nor Klein in his op-ed dealt with was this concept of the casualty figures that are numbers under the control of Hamas. I'm going to provide a link to an article in Tablet magazine done by statisticians from the Wharton College, if I'm remembering correctly, that shows, based on some early numbers and then some later releases, that these numbers are completely bogus. 30,000 dead, and they're all civilians. The graph of total deaths is increasing with almost metronomical linearity. In other words, impossible. And this breakdown explains how in the early days of the war, there was very small variation of about 270 casualties a day, plus or minus 15%. But there should be days with twice the average and other days with more, some days with less, and there wasn't, because the Gaza ministry is releasing fake daily numbers. Strikes on tunnels is going to be different than strikes on apartment buildings, for instance, or neighborhoods. When there are days with many women casualties, there should be a large number of child casualties. But instead, there's more. There's no correlation in these numbers. In other words, they came up with an idea of how many casualties to report per day, and they then backfill the numbers to fit. So on the 3 days when the men's count, the number of men reported killed, is near zero, the women's count is high. The three highest daily women casualty count occurs on the days when almost no men were reportedly killed. The daily totals increase too consistently to be real. They assign 70% of the total to be women and children, maximizing international outcry, and then backfill by the number of men. Now, the other thing is, on February 15th, Hamas admitted to losing 6,000 of its fighters. So when you look at this in totality, Hamas reporting 70% of casualties are women and children, but 20% are fighters, which is not possible unless Israel is not killing non-combatant men, or Hamas is claiming almost all the men in Gaza are Hamas fighters. And if that's the case, how do you restrict these casualties in civilian neighborhoods when all the men are members of Hamas? They're trying to have it both ways. And these casualty numbers never include internecine battles between factions, deliberate killings of, say, people who are calling for peace in Gaza, misfired rockets, accidental explosions. Israel estimates 12,000 fighters have been killed. If that's accurate, the ratio of non-combatant casualties to combatants is between 1.4 to 1 and perhaps as low as 1 to 1 by historical standards of urban warfare, according to this article, where combatants are embedded above and below in the civilian population centers. That is a remarkable and successful effort to prevent unnecessary loss of life. That seems to have escaped Wab Kanu. You're going to hear the reaction of a former Winnipegger who's been living under the bombs, living with the scope of this terror at her doorstep. She looked over Kanu's statement. She had some very strong words for the Premier of Manitoba. You'll hear that when we come back from this break.
Because of you, the Great Canadian Talk Show has made headlines for over 15 years and forced important issues to be acknowledged and dealt with.
The problem here is that they want everything their own way in every situation. It's unpalatable to the general public, but they're frozen out by the process.
There are no subsidies for paying the bills for keeping the government honest.
They just see money. Of course, it's your tax dollars, but it's being spent on their pet projects.
We're on your side.
A lot of these people in special interest groups, they don't bear any relationship to your life out there. They don't have any handle on what your reality is in your neighborhood.
Support old-fashioned investigative reporting that matters.
The best source of information is not the city councilor. It is this program and you listeners.
Support TGCTS today.
Do you have a comment, story tip, or want to advertise or support the Great Canadian Talk Show podcast? Email tgcts1@gmail.com, join the Facebook group, or follow us on Twitter at TGCTS. You have the power.
Just before I launch into the final segment of this episode, looking forward, I've got more coming up about the Bell MTS layoffs, tension being felt within the Unifor union as they're facing in Brandon layoffs or forced relocation for Canada Day. Again, the Winnipeg media, no comment. Nobody from government, nobody from the opposition has commented either. I find that both unbelievable and disgusting. More from City Hall, the battle to save the outdoor pools. The Mandel Métis Federation submitting two excellent letters in support of maintaining and preserving Happyland Park. The more I look at that situation and the way the city administration has approached it, there's no question that there are people inside the city who don't care if they turn St. Boniface into the north end of the south end. They seem to be making a deliberate choice to degrade this neighborhood where I've been for over a dozen years. The people have been fighting back, both at committee and then at EPC. And I'm still owed an interview by Councillor Jason Schreier, and I will get to that. More crime and court reports coming up. And I'm going to be looking at the situation with foster care. You know, the disaster with foster care in this province, the press conference of Police Chief Smythe talking about the butchery, the savagery, the mayhem committed by kids that are 14, 15, 17, abandoned in one case by a 20-year-old, that he linked to lack of resources in foster homes. And here's Kanu's government trying to close down foster homes that actually make things work and keep kids safe and keep them on the straight and narrow. You'd think he'd pay attention to that. The lack of confidence in the business community just released, as I saw in a survey, that is it 28% maybe believe the NDP is fostering job growth, good economic growth? Instead, Wapkinu spends his time worrying about Gaza, spreading falsehoods, telling half the story. Upon seeing Kanu's statement this week, a former classmate of mine, graduate of Joseph Walensky Collegiate, who pretty much immediately after high school, I think it was like literally immediately, like a few months after, moved to Israel, created a life for herself, a traditional Orthodox family. Kids served in the IDF. Have not stayed in touch with her over the years. She's provided articles about life in Israel over the years to Winnipeg Jewish publications. She wrote an open letter to the premier, as she called him, the esteemed Premier Manitoba. I want you all to listen to this and the points she makes. So when somebody brings this up with you, you'll be able to say, yeah, Wapkinu maybe meant well, but he's looking out for his political skin and he's full of shit. Thank you, she wrote, for your concern over the war being fought now in Gaza and for your thoughtful call for a ceasefire. I'm sure it was not an easy call to make. However, you seem to have left out of your argument the following points. Number one, there is more aid going into Gaza than there was before October 7th, when Hamas broke the ceasefire with his pogrom on civilians. While fewer trucks are now entering the strip, they do not include building materials or any other materials that might be used to wage war. However, more food, medicine, water, blankets is going in than before. Number point two, Israel is willing to send even more food and water and medicine if the international community brings it. Her third point, a very important point, it is not Israel's responsibility to feed its enemy, even under the Geneva Convention. Indeed, famine is a weapon of war, which Israel has chosen not to use, because our fight is with Hamas and not the people. Number four, has the esteemed premier not seen the videos of Hamas terrorists atop the roofs of the aid trucks shooting at civilians that have tried to get to the trucks? I'm going to get a screen capture, take a shot of one of those pictures, and I'll put that into the ActionLine version of this podcast. When you go to actionline.ca, as opposed to through Spotify or a podcast platform, and you can read the story, I'll have put in a picture of the Hamas gunman hijacking those trucks. Her fifth point, the hijacking of the aid by Hamas necessitated the airdrops by the USA and others, which turned out to have devastating effects because the people were so desperate the packages not be picked up by Hamas. Her sixth point, in fact, it is Hamas's responsibility to feed its populace as it is the ruling, quote, democratically elected government of Gaza. Number seven, there seems to be enough fuel to fire rockets into Israel, but not enough for hospitals. Yes, rockets are still being fired, she notes. Again, that is the responsibility of the ruling democratically elected government of Gaza. Number eight, Israel has in fact chosen to fight this war, a war thrust upon them by a vicious pogrom perpetrated by Hamas terrorists, not by carpet bombing or firebombing, and certainly not by indiscriminate killing. Our soldiers are going door to door to root out terrorists at a great cost to our soldiers. Number nine, in almost every house they enter, they'll find entrances to tunnels, weaponry, propaganda materials such as copies in Arabic of Mein Kampf, and other materials pertaining to war such as flak jackets and suicide belts. It seems that most of Gaza supports the war. Number 10, anti-Semitism in Manitoba was not caused by this war and it will not end by this war. Please don't blame the victim. Number 11, anti-Semitism in Manitoba is a far bigger, more reaching, and much older problem than you seem to realize. Her 11th point, an easy way to end the war, which could happen today, is for Hamas to release the 134 hostages it's holding, including women, children, and the elderly. Both those kidnapped on October 7th and those it has held for almost 10 years. You might think we've forgotten that, but we haven't. Come out of the tunnels and surrender. Her next point, a ceasefire was in place on October 7th that morning. Hamas repeatedly said it will repeat October 7th over and over again until no Jews remain. The call should not be for a ceasefire. Been there, done that. The call loudly and clearly should be for Hamas to surrender and return the hostages. She then quotes Stephen Harper, as she puts it, a Canadian I can only hope you've heard of. Quoting Harper, this war should end the same way our war with the Nazis did, by the unconditional surrender of its perpetrators. I say to Israel's friends, stop asking it to stop short of victory. Her last point, calling for a ceasefire, may be politically correct, an attempt to pander to all constituencies, but it is, in fact, cowardly and morally corrupt. You can do better. Sincerely, an ex-Manitoban, current resident of southern Israel. I've said on previous podcasts that this is completely unprecedented. I mentioned when the Zionism is racism ball got rolling with Yasser Arafat and his performance at the United Nations. The influence of the Soviet bloc at the time, Palestinianism, an invention of the KGB, Arafat, himself an Egyptian, not a Palestinian. I didn't mention Skokie. In Skokie, Illinois, in 1977, the Nazis, the American Nazis, want to have a march. And the Jewish leadership in that part of Illinois, it's, I think, 20 miles outside of Chicago. So, don't pay attention, let them do it. And one guy stood up and said, no, Holocaust survivors. There's like 6,000 Holocaust survivors in that community. And he stood up, he said, no, we're not going to let them do it. We aren't going to let them do it. We're going to stand against it. Force that march to move to Chicago because they didn't want to face the Holocaust survivors in 1977 in Skokie, Illinois. The Jewish leadership in Canada has pandered for too long to politicians seeking to curry favor like the shtetl Jews of Europe who pandered and don't make waves and shush still until they were being checked off the clipboards as they got on the trains. Wab Kanoo did not show leadership. Political expediency, no different than Trudeau's government, no different than the Biden administration, trying to have it both ways. There will be no two-state solution with anybody who believes in the genocide of Jews. All the progressives, all the leftists, they have to get that out of their head. Now, some of them won't because they themselves are Jew haters. They are anti-Semites. They do not believe in a Jewish state. There's no two-state solution with people who believe Israel should be eliminated. There should be one country, Palestine, with, you know, one government. Not going to happen. And it doesn't matter who leads Israel. Israel will never capitulate to that, and neither will Zionists. And being a Zionist, as my family has been, from what I can tell, for at least five generations, based on the written records I inherited, it's not a dirty word. It's who we are. Ireland for the Irish. Brazil for the Brazilians. France for the French. Israel for the Jews. And there are families that can go back seven generations before the Balfour Declaration. You know that the majority, there's a census in Jerusalem, I think it was the late 1800s, majority of the population of Jerusalem was Jewish. This modern day anti-Semitism hiding behind criticism of Zionism, it's just a cloak for the hatred of Jews, the distrust of Jews. I read to you earlier, Roosevelt managed to not mention the plight of Jews in over 340 press conferences through the course of the war, and didn't even mention Jews in a 1944 commemoration of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Progressive Jews are fooling themselves. The progressive left is full of anti-Semites, full of Jew haters, full of people who hate Western values, many of them being anti-Christian, as well as being anti-Semitic, anti-traditional values, anti-Western values, anti-Western enlightenment. Wabkinu surely having to satisfy the radicals in his caucus as well. We know the NDP, rife with Jew haters, as evidenced by the resignation of Selena Robinson out in British Columbia and statements from other officials out there about their own experiences with the NDPs at the provincial level and at the federal level, the national level. We see the Liberal Party betraying a century of support from Jews in Montreal and Toronto in particular, and Ottawa and Windsor, especially in the East. You're going to see this picture of Joly and Sachs with that supporter of butchery, with that pension provider for terrorists, Abbas. You're going to be seeing that picture over and over again until the federal election. That shows you how, what's the term I'm looking for? Shows you how backwards the moral compass is of our political leadership. Because they fear the mob, the mobs we see on campuses, the mobs we see in Canada. You know, Klein's piece talked about American universities, could have talked about Canadian universities too. Whether it's Concordia, McGill, York, University of Toronto, University of Manitoba, where we've seen chants for Intifada, University of Winnipeg, the repeated so-called academic educational seminars that are all predicated on Zionism is racism, Zionism is colonialism, the state of Israel is made up of white supremacists, even though the majority of the country aren't white by any stretch of the imagination. And so if you see what's happening, if you understand what's going on, if you don't like the direction that your government is taking or not taking, maybe you think that there should be some greater support coming from government for Israel, for the local Jewish communities. A recognition that it's not Islamophobic to be concerned about people who chant for Intifada, who disrupt public utilities and public events, who use coded language to pretend that they aren't outright Jew haters when they are, who decry the basis of Canada as being rooted in racism and colonialism and white supremacy and all the other nonsense. If you're against that divisiveness, take the information I've given you in this podcast, reflect it to your city councilor, to your even your school trustees, by the way, because you don't want this kind of garbage creeping into schools under the guise of DEI. And don't kid yourself how much DEI is influenced by these kinds of political philosophies and directives that open the door to the claims of supporters of Hamas that they are somehow victims of Islamophobia or victims of discrimination. Hamas is adjacent to Nazism. And the Nazis were influential in the politics of Palestine and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, influencing the British mandate to exclude Jews seeking to flee Hitler's slaughterhouses. They adapted Nazi tactics terminology. They continue it to this day. It's been passed down from Arafat's uncle, the Grand Mufti, down to groups like Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the PFLP, the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which is supported and endorsed. We saw a sign in Winnipeg glorifying the martyrs of the PFLP. Nothing done by the cops. Nothing done by the provincial government. Nothing done by Mayor Gillingham either, for that matter. If this concerns you, tell your elected official, no support for terrorism, no support for Sami Doun, for the Palestinian Youth Movement, for these other organizations that funnel money back and forth, including money that's coming from international sources, to create discontent, to undermine unity in our country, to create division, to demonize Israel, and to heap abuse on your Jewish neighbors. What starts with the Jews won't end with the Jews. Send that message to Wab Canoe, to your MPs, your MLAs, and your city councilors. You'll be glad you did, especially when you see how they respond to it. That concludes episode 27. Be back with more of the usual fare, focusing on civic politics, the windup of the budget deliberations and vote, a look at provincial affairs, and especially I'm going to take a look at what's going on with our foster care system. Interviews with newsmakers, that's all there. We are still in our fundraising mode, and I got to ramp it up. We're about $2,000 short of our goal. Please take a moment. Go to the donate page on actionline.ca or contact me directly, martygoldlive@gmail.com. Whether it's through Interact, PayPal, or some other means, I'll come pick up a check. I've done that, and thank you to those that have shown your support for what I'm trying to do to provide independent analysis and investigations of what goes on in our city and our province. You aren't hearing or seeing these things. You don't, certainly not on CBC, not in the Free Press, not on CJOB, not through Global TV. I'm trying to ensure that your voice is heard, that facts are put on the table, that radicalism doesn't overrun our city, our province, and the public square. Your contributions, your donations ensure that I can do this full time. And I appreciate that support, so please do so, whether you email me or go to the donate page. It's going to be a big push for the next 3 weeks. And whether it's, as I've said before, whether it's $100, $200, or $500, it all makes a difference. It makes sure that these podcasts and the stories on Action Line continue, that you can then distribute to your coworkers, your friends, your family, and say, hey, look, we're not alone. Listen to this. This will explain what's going on in our city. And I try to be a little bit entertaining. Sometimes the skewers come out, but I try to do a good job with this. This is the only public affairs podcast in Winnipeg. And I accept that responsibility. I want to continue with it, but it's going to require your support, whether it's through contributions, whether it's through advertising. Get a hold of me. Let's keep this on track. Let's keep this happening. Let's ensure that you have a voice. Let's ensure that Wab Canoe, Mayor Gilliam, all our political leaders, I'm not picking on those two in particular, they're the top of the heap. They have to be held accountable. The media's got to be held accountable. And I'm here, and I will always remind them that you, the audience, the taxpayers, the voters, you have the power. Thank you for listening.
When you support the Great Canadian Talk Show, your donation makes sure that the investigations, the interviews, the fact-finding, the truth-telling can carry on. When you sponsor the Great Canadian Talk Show, you're telling the community that you think their stories matter. Our public affairs coverage continues to make a difference, challenging the slanted media narratives and giving a voice to the community. When you provide funding for the Great Canadian Talk Show, you're supporting old-fashioned investigative reporting that matters. Support TGCTS today.
Thanks for listening to The Great Canadian Talk Show. If you want to email Marty, send it to tgcts1@gmail.com or follow him on Twitter @tgcts.